Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I have a special treat for myself and hopefully for you as well, in that we have one of the new residents here in the studio tonight. He has some previous interest in radio, so I thought I would invite him along to join us here at KSQD. Everyone, welcome to Drew Richard, first year resident, MD at the Dominican Santa Cruz Family Medicine Residency. So welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Dr. Motika. It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for having me on the radio.
I really appreciated some of the things you said about working in theater and music and podcasting. First of all, I'd love to know how you got sucked into that, because it is kind of like quicksand once you get bitten by the bug.
Sure. So I think originally, my roommate and I actually had kind of this motivation to try and do public kind of awareness and public education with health topics. And we were trying to figure out how to make that happen. And so we tried social media, which was neither of our fortes. And we were both definitely outside of our comfort zone. And we were still exploring it at the time. And while this was going on, it was still early in our first year. And one of the faculty members was running a podcast that a lot of the students participated in. And so he invited us on with the kind of brainstorming group. And we joined in the group. We were kind of brainstorming ideas. And another friend and I, who started working on a couple of projects together, we really just connected and popped off with ideas. And so we had ideas for kind of like educational cooking episodes. And so we did some fun episodes of just different cultural dishes to cook that meant something to a different student within the school, like giving them a little bit of their time to share their history, their background, what the dish meant to them. And we tried to keep it healthy, but you know, sometimes a nice dessert dish is healthy for the spirit and the mind. So we also kind of threw in a dish of cookies maybe once or twice. But after that, we just really enjoyed, I guess, providing the space for people to have a conversation about something they'd loved and to do that for others. And so we kind of stepped up into executive producer roles. And from there, we really felt a passion with exactly giving students that voice. And so one of my most favorite experiences on there was there were these two students that were really interested in neuroscience and neurosurgery. And they had done a lot of great work connecting with a neurosurgeon, and they really wanted to pick his brain about, you know, brain surgery. And so they were a little bit nervous, but they did a really great job like building ideas and soundboarding with us. And at the end, when they actually started recording, they really flourished in my mind. And they really opened up, they relaxed. And I think in part, they probably were thankful they overprepared. But in the end, they did so phenomenally well and they had a fun time doing it. And I hope it encouraged them to do things like that in the future. And so, it was a really wonderful experience, and opportunities like that I do enjoy, and just getting the chance to practice myself communicating with others, because it's something that, you know, I think is important to work on regardless of what stage you feel that you can communicate. It's always very easy to feel the illusion of communication, but to miss it when it's not happening.
I think that one of the things that we need as doctors is good communication skills and the ability to show sincerity and rapport. And a lot of that is done with voice nuance, just your tone of voice, your word spacing, what you do at the end or the beginning of the sentence. Those are forms of communication, just like body language, like sitting down in the room with the patient, making eye contact, paying attention, nodding, making those encouraging, I understand sorts of sounds with your mouth, so that rather than like staring at your computer screen, frantically typing while the patient's giving you their history.
No, I agree completely.
So I thought we might talk a little bit about why Santa Cruz and why medicine.
Okay. So both big topics indeed. So Santa Cruz, you mean like the personal choice of why I chose to come to Santa Cruz, correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I chose Santa Cruz for, I think, two reasons. One was the kind of community that within which that I was able to work. And the reason for that was there's a lot of individuals who are suffering from kind of a very disparate level of socioeconomic status compared to some of their peers around them. And I think that that's a really great opportunity to bridge that divide. And that's something that I tried doing, and it was successful in doing, actually, in Southern California, in the San Bernardino area. And so we started a couple of those same individuals whom I mentioned before in that previous story. Actually, we started a nonprofit to kind of do that and help individuals who are experiencing homelessness or were at risk with getting resources, educational or actual tangible resources like food or diapers or baby formula. And so I think that it's completely feasible to do it up here. And it's one of the things that I do enjoy as a slight tangent before I jump back to your other answer there is that I do find that in every community that I go to, I think I have a setup for how I can make a difference and how I can kind of build a program or address the needs of the people. And I am always so gobsmacked that I learn every time, and I need to learn to just keep an open mind with it, that every community is so uniquely different. And it is a really, you cannot underestimate the intersectionality of different needs, backgrounds, experiences, just lived people. And so once again, I find myself kind of not starting at square one necessarily, but definitely taking a few steps back to appreciate and smell the air and really get a good feel for what this community can really benefit from, where there might be gaps, and not to make any assumptions, because that's something I've also learned, is that it's easy to make an assumption of a need in a community and drive after it, only to find out later that there's plenty of other organizations doing similar work. And so, you know, rather than like splitting hairs and dividing what work you could do, why not do it together? And that, if I may, before I take too much time, gets into why medicine. And that's because at its root, I have a real respect and love for humans. And what I mean to say is that I know we draw a really short stick for ourselves sometimes, and we're really hard on ourselves as a whole. But the capacity for good that I see in us is so overwhelming. It's so, I think, something that we're not used to, that we kind of overwrite it as something that could be. But I see it in little things. And it's as simple as just watching someone else kind of be there for someone else, to, even with the small actions, like getting something that they dropped on the ground. You might think that's a mundane or very small action, but I think that's a really powerful kind of, that person could have kept about their business. They could have kept doing what they were doing. They didn't have to expend that energy. And while it's small, all of those small things add up. And I think that that's something that we as humans could drive towards supporting more. And so me for medicine is to help people cultivate the ability to be a little bit more compassionate towards others. And I wanted to do that by focusing on their health.
I think that the mission of being a healer and healing first involves deciding where the healing is. And that's something I find myself asking when I walk into any situation, because I may not be able to heal that cancer, but I may be able to heal that relationship or guide that relationship to a place of healing and peace, so that the person who's left behind isn't haunted by unfinished business, but yet may not know how to move forward through it. And I know that sounds very psychological and counseling, probably because of my psychological degree. That's my undergrad. I don't see any wall between the mind and the body. I think Descartes was wrong about that whole dualism thing. And our minds control our body functions. Our bodies control our minds. And we're not even just us, right? We're walking around with this microbiome and these multiple levels of consciousness and subroutines in our heads. So we're already a collective to start with. And then as we move into where is our survival, where is our healing, it's in the collective, in the cooperation and a more ecosystem approach to both the body and the society. You see those inputs and outputs. I find I've become very fascinated with economics, because of the way it looks at these systems and, like I said, inputs and outputs, and makes, you know, predictions about where your leverage points are in terms of finding that healing and making it happen.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. I have many perspectives on economics, but I don't think I've ever compared it to the human health as one of them. But I can see where you're saying in terms of the the vast degree of kind of, well, with economics, you have this algorithm. If only with medicine, it was kind of that easy to put everything into an algorithm.
Oh, please, we don't tried. Go there. No algorithm. Well, the problem is that the most scientific algorithm that we create is going to work for a statistically significant mm-hmm. number of people
only
and
some.
Leave the outliers in the dust. And those are the people that you see are the outliers, the people who need a hand. And in statistics, you don't care about the ones who fall off, but in humanity, you do, mm-hmm. or you should. Let's be clear, yeah. You should. The sort of Marlboro man, every man, every person for himself, rugged individual, it's an illusion. It's a delusion. They're fine until they need a tow truck or an ambulance or a doctor.
Yep.
And then suddenly, they really need somebody else. And it's hard to get past that sort of cultural fantasy of independence. Have you ever lived in Texas, Drew?
No, I haven't. But, you know, when you say that, I did live in upstate rural New York, and there is a similar do-it-yourself type of nature and vibe to it. New Yorkers pride themselves on minding their own business and sticking to their own work. And so it's very similar in that streak of independence and wanting to do things themselves. And it also has consequences, though, in that same, you were hinting at it without directly touching upon it, which is, it is almost a fear. I would go so dramatic as to say, to ask for help. And I don't think that a lot of people can identify that as a fear because they don't recognize that what they're afraid of. And that's that, you know, expressing vulnerability, the paranoias that they might be held against them, all of these different things, when sometimes the simple act of helping another, as we've been talking about, is so rewarding in itself. So I think that, you know, that hyper-independence is something that we hopefully as a group can all work on together and get past this kind of need or perception that someone who doesn't need anyone else is somehow an improvement on a person that would rather benefit from help from everyone. That's crazy.
Yeah, I agree. And one of the things that I see that is good about medicine of your generation versus mine is we are accepting that there's a team. There's all sorts of support people. There's the scrub nurse. There's the circulating nurse. There's the surgeon. There's the anesthesiologist. There's the nurses and phlebotomists who got the patient set up in the first place. And a very important book came out probably about 10, 15 years ago called The Checklist Manifesto.
Atul Gawande?
Yes. Well, Atul Gawande has gone on to write many books, but that was when he first kind of appeared on my horizon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shortly after that book came out, and many of my patients have said, yeah, your doctor did this really funny thing. He told me the night before the surgery to take a Sharpie and on the knee that we're going to operate on, write the words yes, and on the knee that we're not going to operate on, to write the words no, so that when I go in and I'm unconscious, that because think about it for a moment, in surgery, you're covered with blue sheets. The part of the body that is exposed is not really exposed. It's been kind of painted this brilliant sort of rusty orange translucent color. It's almost exactly the color of the yellow traffic light. And then wrapped in plastic, and then more plastic and sticky has been put around. So essentially, you are this limb on the table or this abdomen on the table. And it's very easy to make a mistake about what was this the gallbladder or was this the nephrectomy or you know, which knee were we replacing on this patient when you've got six lined up? And it's not like anyone wants to make that mistake, but enough of it was being made that it's like, okay, what's the simple expedient here? While the person who's doing the wiping down comes across the word no, and they go, ah, maybe I better check the notes before I prep the wrong leg. Just the acknowledgement of the importance of everyone and that we are all doing the same thing. It's rather like the pep talk that is given in a team, you know, by the coach, you know, and that's new. I don't know if you realize it, but that is not how it used to be. It used to be very much general commanding lieutenants and privates and very hierarchical and not opportunity to question or to suggest. You were just going to hold that retractor, hold it where I tell you, you know, do what I tell you to do. And I think that was not just in the operating room. I'm using that as the metaphor, but it was also a very hierarchical medical structure, and the patient was not an equivalent player in that hierarchy. Their job was to listen to the doctor and do what the doctor said, and given human nature, that did not work very well, but that's how we did it.
Hmm. And thank you for sharing that, because I was curious the lens that you kept drawing with that was that it was such a different time. And that is something that was been throughout my entire training at the California University of Science and Medicine, was that you are a team, and to kind of, and we did interprofessional kind of field trip days to different groups to actually learn about what they did, work with them, and understand it. And so I understand, I guess, how that worked functionally, but I find that bewildering as an experience, and that must have been something so different. And to see how it is now with all of these different opportunities to provide those panels to feedback for one another, whether it's our morning reports now or whether it's our smaller team huddles, there's a lot of opportunities constantly that I thought was the norm. So I'm glad to hear that that's a positive development for medicine. Well, old habits die hard too. So, you know, there are certainly still those moments that things came up where a hierarchy was felt or it was a little challenging to feel the ability to speak up. But I will say it was fewer and farther between than I've heard from the stories. But yeah, that is a big cultural change in medicine. goodness, when you were asking about changes in medicine, I was starting with the more obvious ones, like just like the more amounts of like procedures and drugs that we've got to memorize. But honestly, if I may tangent on that and get back to our point still, I think with that has also come a little bit more compassion, from like faculty members and senior staff members, because it is definitely a little bit more forgiving with medications, with dosages, because there are so many and such nuances between a 0.1 milligram of a certain drug versus you need 600 milligrams of a different drug, that the faculty has become a little bit more like open to med students making a few mistakes and then guiding them into the right direction, rather than the very punitive, you cannot make those mistakes types of behaviors that I heard about in the past. So it's been a better learning experience for medical students. Thankfully, it's still stressful for sure, but it definitely sounds like it has improved. So that's very good to hear. I'm glad.
I want to reintroduce Dr. Drew Richard, who is a first year resident at the just recently started Dominican Family Medicine Residency. I say that with great joy, as I'm one of the founding faculty here and extremely proud of that fact. Dr. Richard is we have a call coming in. Let's go ahead and see what that's about. Hello, you're on the air, and please give us your name and where you're calling from.
My name is Ian, and I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Well, hello, Ian. Go ahead. What would you like to talk about?
Well, just first, thank you for this really interesting conversation. My question is, as a functional medicine practitioner, I've often wondered, what is your opinion about factors that normal or the paradigm of standard medicine does not consider relevant at all to a person's health? What do you think about things like intangibles like intention, purpose? What do you think about the person's attitude and things like that? And also, what do you think about other methodologies like sound healing and I forgot to add, what do you think about energy? So I would just like to hear either you or Dr. Richards talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think I'm going to start off and then let Drew fill in where he feels comfortable. First of all, I'll put on my functional medicine hat and say that at the center of this piece of paper that we call the matrix that basically puts all of the different functionalities and all of the different inputs. It's essentially like one of those maps you see of the water cycle, the carbon cycle, the water cycle, the ecosystem, the what was it, the snow leopards and the rabbits. You know, it's that circle of life that, in the case of this piece of paper, is representing an individual, but it also represents all the externals that are feeding into that individual's health. At the center of the matrix, we have mental, emotional, and spiritual. And we are a spiritually penic society. We don't identify spirituality as a value. It's kind of considered, you know, an irrelevant detail, but it's really fundamental, among other things, to having meaning in your life, and also to reducing stress, and to having a way to plug into to the greater universe and the love that surrounds us. So that is right at the center of the matrix, along with the emotional aspects. Has this person had trauma in their life? Do they trust the universe? Are they anxious? Are they angry? Are they reflexively negative and pessimistic? Because that not only influences how their body responds to disease, which we know, but it also influences their risk of cancer. It influences their response to drugs and how likely they are to have side effects. And then the mental aspects, you know, the story that you tell yourself, your level of understanding and how you think about problems. Are you a person who's an analytic person who likes to separate all the pieces and go really deep into one? Are you a person who's more of a broad thinker? And that's going to be very important for me as the physician healer to understand as I approach the patient. And then we have to think about all of those externals, like family and past medical history, and also just what's going on in the body nutritionally. What are the inputs there? What about nutrition and hydration? What about excretion? Are they actually getting rid of toxins, or do I need to be afraid that they are essentially walking around in a semi-poisoned state? And then you asked about energy, so I'm going to take off my functional medicine hat and put on my acupuncturist hat, and I'm going to say that our bodies are electrical. We have a field that can be detected with instruments, you know, 6 feet from our body easily. You could do an EKG from across the room if you wanted to. And we all have our own field, which means that we're all able to sense other people's fields. Have you ever walked into a room and known immediately that there was anger in that room? Or that you're walking in on a fight, and you may not even have any visual cues. In fact, people who are blind are even better at picking up emotional energy in a room than people who are sighted, because they're less distracted. So that's very clear. And then when I do acupuncture on someone, I'm like a harpist. I'm plucking the strings of this energy field to try to change the way it's vibrating, to try and maybe influence blood flow or lymph flow to an area. And when I started doing this, I was like, well, I'm going to do what they told me to do, just like when I was in medical school. And it's like, okay, well, this is how you do this procedure. So you do it that way. And then you're like, first time I scrubbed in on a surgery, it's like, I can't believe this woman is going to survive having her abdomen open like that. And yeah, they sew her up. And a week, 2 days later, she's like walking around, waves at me in the hall. And it's miraculous. So the energy stuff is really miraculous, and so many things they taught me couldn't be treated with modern medicine. They were right, but they can be treated with energy medicine. So that's my take.
Yeah, and if I may jump in, I think functional medicine is definitely gaining in both just understanding and awareness within the field of medicine. It's something that we certainly learned about within both my medical school and now in residency. So it's certainly becoming common practice, I would say, to at least be aware and informed about all of the options that you can treat patients with. And I think a lot of individuals are finding their own niches within that, that they are able to at least kind of wrap their heads around. And I think that one of the points that you brought up was probably the more common of that, which would be sound healing and sound baths. I think that an on paper abstraction, A lot of people, especially if you introduce it to a patient, might be caught a little sideways from it, and they might be like, what do you mean? But if you can rephrase it in a way that they understand, I think, and especially when we were talking about other subjects earlier, like music, it's many, many people have a very like particular song or genre of music or sound that can really evoke particular emotions, feelings. It can even give them goosebumps. I know I have that myself. There is definitely some tracks, some orchestral tracks, especially from, I'll nerd out here a little bit, The Lord of the Rings, that I even before watching The Lord of the Rings, it would give me goosebumps. And that was something that always got me kind of into that series. But nonetheless, sound can be very healing. And I think that it's important to maybe be ready to kind of stage how you explain that conversation to someone, because it's just very easy to miscommunicate this concept that I think that they themselves would agree with. But if you address it in terms that are so foreign and unfamiliar to them, they might be like, I don't understand what you're saying. I don't think that's possible for me. But if you know, you start the conversation a little bit differently, and rather than, you know, talking to that patient about, hey, have you tried a sound bath before? And they're like, no, I'm okay. But you're like, hey, do you have a favorite song? And they're like, oh yeah, I love this one artist. And you're like, perfect. Why don't you listen to them for 5 minutes? You take some little moment to yourself and you just kind of clear your thoughts and meditate. And it, you know, is achieving the same outcome and effect, but you know, you don't have to start them off in this world that's so foreign and unfamiliar to them, and they feel uncomfortable from the start. And that might predispose them to having negative kind of appreciation for sound healing or sound baths when, you know, if you'd dress another way, they'd be totally understanding and in agreement. So I think it's a matter of how you perceive it and give that perception off. And that's all just a matter of communication as we tie back to our beginning.
As a matter of fact, we actually treated the residents to a sound bath in the last couple of weeks from a local practitioner. And it was very well received, I think.
Oh, it was lovely. Yeah, I can speak on behalf of that. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any follow-up questions?
Oh, no. I'm just trying to process everything you've said. Thank you very much.
Oh, well, you're welcome. And, of course, you can go to askdrdon.com, C-O-M, and pick up the MP3 by Monday. Next Monday it'll be up. That's usually done by then. So you can download it and listen to it as many times as you need to. Thank you very much. Bye-bye. In the studio with me, Dr. Drew Richard, a first-year medical resident at our own Dominican Santa Cruz Family Medicine Residency, and regular listeners have heard me talk about that often enough. We're going to pivot now to talking about why singing is good for your brain. What we have to do is get over being uncomfortable, because you don't have to be Beyonce. Music has the power to soothe the mind and promote brain health and bring people closer together. So let's talk about some of the research. I like this quote from Daniel Levithan. He's a professor of neuroscience at McGill University and the dean of arts and humanities at Minerva University, quite the Renaissance man, Mr. Levithan. He says, nobody tells you you shouldn't jog if you're not good at it. That's absolutely not the point. And I really think that's true. Music can move us emotionally, physically. It can help us connect with other people. And these are all the most important elements of mental health. Daniel Bowling, a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Stanford, near to us here, researches music-based treatments for mental health. For example, studies have shown that listening to music we enjoy is associated with better scores of subjective well-being, stress reduction, and an increased ability to cope with negative emotions while lifting up positive ones. Just as Drew was saying earlier, even 5 minutes of listening to your favorite music and putting yourself in a positive frame of mind, well, you actually are. Research shows that music that you like releases dopamine, a reward hormone that makes you feel warm and fuzzy. But if you make music yourself with your, not just listening, but with your voice, it adds another dimension to the experience. You get more energy, agency, and ownership when you make your own music. There's lots of studies about singing karaoke. Have you ever sang karaoke?
You know, as much as I like sing in my own time and kind of just in private in the shower, I haven't done formal karaoke with friends all that often, maybe once or twice, if I'm being honest. And it is a bit of that shyness. I do prefer to sing like kind of in the privacy of my own space.
I have a great shower stall, personally.
The acoustics in the shower are better.
Just amazing. Well, yeah. The car's not bad either. But what I notice is when I'm singing along to something I like, I'm able to auto-tune and be more on key, because the yeah. professional the professional aspect of it is getting to the point where you actually are on key, and that's where singing in a choir helps. But here's a study of 8,000 Swedish twins found that the more time you spent playing music, it was associated with better emotional awareness. And since this was a twin study, they were able to differentiate a lot of other genetic factors and environmental factors related to upbringing that might have made a difference there. Other research shows that it protects brain health by promoting neuroplasticity. Now that the population is aging, a whole lot of money is getting thrown at how do we not have an entire cohort of Alzheimer's patients that require a great deal of care, and how do we prevent the disease rather than just treating the disease? One study of 132 older adults reported that 6 months of piano practice led to increases in gray matter in the brain and improvements in auditory working memory, and that's basically short-term memory of sounds. Another study that I remember reading was in early Alzheimer's patients, not quoted here, so I can't give you all the details, but what they would do was pitch matching. So they would play a tone into one ear, and then you would have a little rheostat dial, and you would have to dial the tone in your other ear to match it. And the fact that you were crossing the brain, that appears to be a really influential thing neurocognitively, is if you can bounce stuff back and forth across the brain, it forces the production of more synapses, particularly in the hippocampus. Another study showed that practicing piano for a year improved general cognitive flexibility, which this was a study of 153 older adults just published this year. So maybe part of what learning to play music does is enable us to physically and mentally engage with some of the greatest works ever produced, the most complex, is something very cool of being able to sit down at the piano and put your fingers where Chopin put his fingers when he was making the same sounds. It sort of speaks to that continuity of human creativity, and the fact that we can write down music and send it forward into the centuries where it can be appreciated is pretty magic, actually, when you think about it.
I agree, and I think that you bring up a good point in all of these varied studies that you've mentioned, and I think that it's not necessarily just about singing with the music. I think it's really the engagement with the music, and that could actually kind of harken back to what our friend caller was talking about earlier, and that's just kind of that intention with getting involved with the music. And so if I may take this opportunity, it doesn't necessarily have to be singing, but I do hope that all of the listeners today, and if you share this with others, might take a moment to just get engaged with a favorite sound or song that you like. And it doesn't have to be singing, but you can just tap your knee or tap your leg. But just be engaged with the song that you're listening to while you clear your mind and meditate and see how that feels for you. And I think that might go kind of in parallel with some of these studies. And it's not about the skill level. You don't have to be, Mozart on the piano. But just playing a few keys to a song that you like in the piano, I think would be engaging. And I think you would find surprising if you haven't tried it before. I know I have.
What has been your experience with group music making? And I'm talking not about your professional experience, but more your internal experience and reaction to it.
You mean like...
Well, being, for example, being part of a band or an orchestra or singing with a group.
You know, in a lot of the musical experiences that I've had, and maybe this is perhaps why I've had a different kind of like value to music than others, it was always very independent. Mm-hmm. So I was a drummer, but I was never a part of a band or anything like that. I had a little drum kit in the basement, and that's where I played. And so I loved it. I loved the drums. I am definitely, I need a good drum line or a bass line in my music at all times. Otherwise I'm suffering. But no, I kid. But, I think that I just lost my train of thought. Bring me back to your question.
Individual, group.
Oh, well,
group.
Yes, group music.
Yeah.
So I never personally had that experience, but I think that from what I've seen from friends that were in bands, like whether that was like group bands, like the school bands or something like that, or the indie amateur like punk rock bands back from East Coast New York. But I think that it creates not only a space for a shared activity, which we know creates bonding like opportunities as it is. I think that that power of creating not just an, a very unique form of art together, which is not just a visual form of art that, you know, kind of hits in our occipital lobe and then in our eventual kind of memories in our hippocampus. And it just kind of rests deep there. But a sound is something kind of special at times, in my opinion, just because the way that it makes your body feel is also a sensation that you can interpret mm-hmm. alongside of the audio waves that you
well,
take
in. Well,
we're
made of water and we vibrate.
Mm-hmm.
If the sound is loud enough, your entire body is vibrating and mm-hmm. the room is vibrating and any hard surface around you is vibrating. And then you have all the secondary reflections mm-hmm. around. And that's an interesting thing, I think, physiologically, because it does entrain blood flow in various regions. And when I have been in music, I did a lot of musical theater coming through school, and I played in the orchestra and I sang. And my mother was a singer and loved choral music. So naturally I was in choirs. When you are all singing together, and I loved doing like four-part harmony, like barbershop and madrigals, because the voices would intertwine and interweave, and then you would all hit a note, four different notes, but the vibration it made was shared through the entire group, and it really felt like a communion, if you will. It really increased, I think, my sense of connection, and it was very comforting. In the sense of like the purring cat on your lap or the hug from your friend or cuddling up with your mom, it was comforting at that level. And I think for me, that shared vibration, I think that's why people get into raves, really, is the music. They're all feeling the same beat. They're all moving more or less in sync.
They try, I'm sure.
Well, you know, allowing for the MDMA and whatever else might be floating around in their bloodstream. But there is a real transcendent aspect to it. There's the Flower Song from Lakmé, which is an opera, is these two beautiful female voices intertwining with each other. You will have heard it. I've gotten, as I hit middle age, I started to really appreciate opera as a sort of, the music was creating the emotion of what the actors were doing and telling you what emotion to feel, which is like movie music, right? It tells you what to feel. Oh, no, real digression. Have you seen the Netflix Hitchcock film that's running right now? It's a movie about Alfred Hitchcock making Psycho, and it's actually...
Oh, no, I haven't yet.
It's really good.
Oh, I do mean to watch that.
It's really good. And they do spend some time talking about he didn't want there to be any music for the shower scene. And they basically talked him into it. And of course, that music in the shower screen, I can just like play it in my brain.
It's a classic, yeah. It is iconic. It is.
And so... I'm thinking also of like the spaghetti westerns mm-hmm. and the way that set the mood and the sound of, you know, the sound of the wind in the desert. And then there's that little do-do-do-do-do-do.
Mm-hmm. Another classic.
Mm-hmm. I'm a classic myself. So what do you expect?
Well, I see. I use that colloquially just to more mean to be something timeless.
Yes, I'm working on the timeless part.
There are modern day classics too. But no, I very much agree. And I think that, again, I'm always surprised when, and this is something that I've been very curious about, when I hear from people, I don't know if you've met these people, you ask them, you know, like, what kind of music do you like? And they're like, oh, I don't listen to music. And I'm always curious. I've never like delved deeper into it, but I'm always curious if like how music sounds to them, I suppose, and what their experiences with it are, and if that generalizes to all sounds, like sounds just don't, are not appreciated by them in the same way that someone else might, or how that kind of manifests itself in someone. I'm always very curious, maybe, and sometimes like with kids, like it was picky eaters. They just haven't had enough of a wide enough palate to be like, oh, I actually like all of these different things too that constitute as healthy foods too, but I just never knew about them. Cause you know, and especially for me and like my kind of like rural upstate New York, we had a lot of corn, a lot of apple, a lot of like asparagus and veggies. But there's a lot of other fruits and veggies out there than just a handful. And the different forms of tomatoes out there. It has been a beautiful journey. I'm learning the difference of tomatoes. I have enjoyed it.
Green zebras.
Is that a type of tomato?
That's a tomato.
I'll have to investigate.
You are in for a treat this summer. You'll be able to get them at the farmers markets. And they are small, green. They look a little bit, mostly like a watermelon.
Hmm.
But they're ripe. You can tell. They can push them.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a somewhat more lemony flavor than the usual cucumber.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like if we're going to do sommelier for tomatoes, you know, there's a suspicion of tomatillo. There's a tiny little touch of lemon, and there's a more earthy flavor underneath and a little dill pickle.
Hmm. Wow. And that's the zebra tomato.
That's the green zebra.
The green zebra. Okay. I will have to keep my eye out for this summer. And we're getting close.
Oh, they're out there.
Oh, they're out there already?
They're out there.
Oh, I'll have to look around.
I'm going to go pick tomatoes tonight when I get home.
Oh, very cool. And that's another reason, back to the earlier topic
why
of why
Santa Cruz.
Yep, absolutely. It's a lovely, lovely community, lovely agrarian place, which is a lot like my home in upstate New York, Honeyway Falls. Very lovely place. Grew up on a lot of farms. We had a lot of apples in the area, which I don't see as much around here. The apples are a little on the pricey side, I will say.
You have not been down to Watsonville.
You're right.
We have major apple production down there. Orchards still standing that are probably 100 years old now.
Good. That was a really fun pastime on the East Coast, was going to orchards and picking apples. It was a really great time. I'll have to look into doing that over in Watsonville.
We have to organize. You can bring some of your residency buddies down and clear my trees, and we can give. I can't pick my trees by myself, and a whole lot of apples lie on the ground that could be being given away.
Yeah, you know, that's funny that you mentioned that. That was actually one part of what V Corporation down in San Bernardino does, was go to various like private or public kind of owned orchards and food ventures and recycle food from going on the floor and giving it to places that could use it. So that's, yeah, no, happy to. I actually can get some friends from the area as well, outside of just residents.
Yeah.
We can get a big group. Yeah, okay. That was our medicine and music.
No, that's all right. We can tangent all we want. Let's tangent over to exercise. Rumor has it that you're learning surfing.
Yes. Learning is definitely the key word. I'm entirely impressed. My entire residency cohort has become kind of enthralled with surfing. We've all gotten interested in it.
Surfing USA class of, let's see, you guys will graduate in 2028, is that right?
Mm-hmm. 2028, yeah, and hopefully we'll all have been surfing for 3 years by now. That is one thing that I think is really exciting. It's nice to have both a residency bonding experience and still something that you can be outdoors in nature, getting some exercise in. And I personally am not a fan of running. So the paddling on the surfboard, the perfect exercise cardio for me in the morning or in the evening. One big plug to surfing, I tried it because it was one of my East Coast farm boy goals. I was like, this is how people on the West Coast live. I want to be like that. So I wanted to surf, or at least try it. What I didn't expect was to like love surfing. And that's because I always, and some of my friends, I hear this and them too, when I try and bring them out, the ocean apprehension, a lot of fears of the ocean, big space, Not sure of all the little creatures inside of it, but you know, I kind of just threw myself out there because I really wanted to try surfing, and I was impressed with how quickly I was able to get over that apprehension and fear. And when you're out there surfing, you're not over like sheer cliff of oblivion abyss and the darkness looks at you. No, you're over like very like shallow reefs of sand and rock and a lot of seaweed and kelp. And so you never are like feeling like you're lost in an abyss.
Bump.
Yeah.
Bump.
You never feel that way. I thought I would. I was terrified and I was like trying to figure out how fast I could get back to shore, but no, you're totally fine. And so it's been wonderful. And I really enjoy it. And I'm thankful for one of my co-residents, Devin, for getting me into it and getting the whole residency into it, frankly.
Yeah, she's a little surfing mad, but that's good.
We needed it.
Oh. Yes. No, we totally.
We did.
Part of wellness is regular exercise. And we'll segue into how exercise helps you not get cancer. We're going to get into a little physiology. But before we leave movement and waving the hands around and paddling behind, I did want to point out the paradox of the conductors, because it kind of blends the music, which is to say conductors live longer than they should based on their behavior, their habits, their cholesterol, and their cardiovascular fitness. Even though all they do is stand there and wave their arms all day, that's actually excellent exercise for the heart. And
I bet.
And so it's, if you're wanting to work on your cardiac fitness, you could conduct to your music.
Yeah, and no, absolutely. And for anyone that's questioning that, I encourage you to hold your arms up in front of you for more than 5 minutes and you'll feel the burn. And they do that for an hour plus. That's awesome. I can very much believe that.
It's a trip. Leonard Bernstein was a chain smoker. I think he lived to be about 85. And but it's not, it's totally common. They live a long time. So we know that exercise statistically and epidemiology helps with not getting cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And so these researchers at the University of Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania decided to see if they could figure out what was the X factor. What was the thing about exercise? What did it change? So they were thinking they were going to find give the spoiler. Let me tell you how they did the study. First of all, they got themselves an aggressive form of melanoma, and they were going to inject it into mice. So in preparation for this, one group got put on a 4-week exercise regimen, presumably wheels and swimming, while the others were kept in smaller cages and were fairly sedentary. And then they injected them, and then they hung out for a while, and then killed them and looked to see how long they lived and how big were their tumors. So what they found was that the ones who exercised had smaller tumors and better survival rates. That's no surprise. Here's what they did that was the twist. They gave some of that exercise cohort antibiotics, and it completely destroyed the benefit of exercise. So, Dr. Richard, what could be the X factor there?
Interesting.
Antibiotics, what do they kill?
It's definitely probably having to do with your gut biome. My original thought when you were first starting this topic was actually that, well, we know that exercise improves our insulin sensitivity and our ability to process sugar. And there's also been many studies that go into how cancer is kind of basically a sugar fiend. Because it is undergoing so much, so many divisions and so many respirations per second that it's kind of using up all of that glucose. And so if you kind of inhibit some of that glucose feeding into it, you can kind of help stave off and even let your body, and your body can fight off cancer. It's just developed ways of evading it. But you know, if you give it the right components, this is why people go into remission and eventually kind of see these turns around in their health. And
exactly.
So, yeah, makes sense.
Well, it is kind of the microbes, but, it actually was the metabolites of the microbiome. So we have machine learning now, so we can, like, the microbiome makes thousands of metabolites. They measured the metabolites in the groups of mice, And what they found was present in the exercisers and absent in the exercise plus antibiotic group was formate. And this is a metabolite of bacteria increased by exercise. But what does formate do? It increases the potency of CD8 T cells in the immune system, which are the key cancer-fighting cells, along with the natural killer cells. So then they looked at 19 humans with advanced melanoma, and the ones with high levels of formate in their bloodstream had a longer progression-free survival. And this is a look-back study. So they were they weren't looking at exercise levels. They were looking at previous blood tests and the longest-lived melanoma survivors who had already died, obviously, by the time they did this study in the look-back, had higher levels of formate. So this is evidence that supports the idea that this metabolite might benefit. And we need to, as we do our microbiome research, we need to start looking at the metabolome, as it's called. So it's not the genome, and it's not just what our own body is making, but what all of the other little tiny bodies inside our big body are making. And some of these things like vitamin D and vitamin K are bacterial metabolites that have become nutrients over the many, many millions of years that mammals have been running, well, guts have been running around, because this probably is also true for lizards. But the guys in there have, you know, said, hey, you know, I'm really good at making this. You know, you don't need to make any more of it. And then we lose the ability to make it. Just like we lost the ability to make vitamin C. Most mammals can make vitamin C, but the apes can't.
Hmm.
And that's because they are primarily vegetarians, and they were in the tropics, and they basically ate citrus.
Oh, wow.
So they always had plenty of vitamin C available, so they stopped.
I didn't know that about
other mammals. Yeah. Yeah, dogs can make their own vitamin C. Yeah, they don't need it. They just make it in their liver.
That's why they've got healthy gums. Okay. I see.
Well, I don't. So there are the microenvironment is, of course, not just colorectal cancer. It's inflammatory bowel disease. And if we can tap into the pathways of these specific molecules, you know, obviously everybody's going, oh, money, we can make drugs. Woo-hoo. But we're going to have to end it there. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on the program. Dr. Drew Richard, it's been a real pleasure. I hope you'll come back on the show sometime. And this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.